This is sort of an outline of what I'll talk about. First of all, some basic concepts that came from experiments that we did a little while ago. Then some applications, the prediction of protein folding mechanisms, trying to predict how proteins fold up, the process of folding, the design of protein folding mechanisms, and then finally the prediction of protein structure. And I think given what you've heard so far, I think I'll spend probably most of my time on this last issue, the prediction of protein structure from sequence. And please interrupt me as I go along if things aren't clear. One of the first experiment that we did when I started my research group, we wanted to know whether to what extent the process of folding has been optimized by natural selection. And these experiments are sort of the experimental analog of calculations that Eugene has probably told you about that were probably done maybe a little bit before we did these experiments. So the way that we did this experimentally was we want to know whether the sequences of naturally occurring proteins were optimized to fold fast. And so the way we did this experiment was to generate in the laboratory very, very different sequences and then compare their folding rates. And the idea was that if the process has been optimized, then one would expect that when one changes the amino acid sequence by a large amount, that the folding rate should on average slow down. Is there a pointer or something? So this shows a protein called the SH3 domain, and what we did was to make in the laboratory, we made millions, actually hundreds of millions of different sequences for the SH3 domain, and then selected out those that were still able to fold up to a stable folded structure. And this particular experiment, we also wanted to know whether we could build this protein from a reduced amino acid alphabet. So nature uses 20 amino acids. In this experiment, we wanted to see whether we could build a protein like this from just a 5 amino acid alphabet. We made hundreds of millions of sequences which were primarily from a 5 amino acid alphabet, and then selected out those sequences which still folded up to that structure, and this shows on the schematically the sequence of the most simplified protein that we obtained in these selections. And red indicates that the amino acid at that position is one of five amino acids in our reduced alphabet. For technical reasons, we couldn't change these residues that are up here in blue. So we were able to make this protein, and we've been able to solve the structure of it using NMR. And this protein, here's the structure of the naturally occurring protein. Here's the structure of the protein that's made from primarily from this 5 amino acid alphabet. And they're roughly the same. I mean, this structure is somewhat distorted because it has all these substitutions in it. But the structure is, the overall topology is very similar. So what this suggests is that that proteins can be made from a reduced set of amino acids. One doesn't really need 20 amino acids. And go ahead. What do you say?
Why 5?
Well, actually, what we initially tried to do was to use 3: a positively charged amino acid, a negatively charged amino acid, and a hydrophobic amino acid. And we weren't able to do that. We need to add 2 more, one which is glycine, which allows very sharp turns in this polypeptide chain, and another residue, alanine, which basically we had the hydrophobic residue that we chose was too large to completely, if you put that hydrophobic residue at all core positions, it would have been overpacked, so we needed alanine in some positions. I think it's been suggested to us that if we had chosen valine, which is intermediate in size, we could have gotten away with 4. What? Lysine, which is positive, glutamate, which is negative, and isoleucine were our first 3, and then we added to that alanine and glycine.
And how well packed is that?
It's a reasonably well. I mean, we were able to solve the NMR structure. The person who was solving it decide to never do NMR again after that. Because you can imagine, if you know about how NMR structures are determined, you first have to identify which residues, which resonances go with which residue. And if you only have five types of amino acids, you have a lot of redundancy. So the way this works is, that's what this picture explains. It took advantage of the fact that the folding of the protein, this protein binds a peptide, which is shown in yellow here. In order for the protein to bind the peptide, the protein has to be folded. And that's why we had to keep these residues fixed, because we were using binding as a core folder. We're now doing experiments, which I wasn't going to tell you about, in which we're making completely random sequences, and we have a more general selection for folding. So we're trying to see if we can get folded sequences, folded proteins from completely random sequences. But yeah, that's a good question. We could probably count them. Maybe 9 or 10. And there are also these residues in black are also were not simplified. Probably so. Yeah. Part of it could just be that when you do these combinatorial library selection experiments, you're not sampling all of sequence space, so that we were only able to make we weren't able to fully sample the space. There are a couple of these which you can actually change to one of the five letters, and there are a couple which you can't. So some of them are playing genuinely important roles that are not that you can't get by with one of the five amino acids. Okay, well now we did this experiment on this protein and also on another protein called protein L, where what we did is we made in the laboratory these sequences which were quite different from the naturally occurring amino acid sequence. And now we wanted to ask the question, how do the folding rates of these proteins compare to the folding rates of their naturally occurring counterparts? And again, if the naturally occurring sequence had been extensively optimized to fold rapidly, then you might expect that these proteins we create in the laboratory would fold more slowly. Here is the results on protein L, and this is the wild type protein is shown on the left here, and the free energy of folding is on this upper panel, and higher means more stable, and these are just the stabilities of variants that came through this selection. And what you see is that the wild type protein is more stable than all of the things that came through the selection. And that's not terribly surprising, because we're not selecting in particular for high stability. We're just selecting for the ability to bind this peptide. So the naturally occurring sequence is more stable, makes a more stable protein than the sequence that's come through the selection. Now here's the folding rate. So here's the folding rate of the wild type protein, and what you see is that some of the proteins that come through our selection fold more rapidly, and some fold more slowly. There's actually about half fold more rapidly, half fold more slowly. So again, if the folding rate had really been optimized, you'd expect to see the folding rates of these proteins all considerably less. So at least for this protein, you can drastically perturb the sequence, and the folding rate doesn't get much smaller. For this simplified SH3 domain that I showed you, that protein actually folds three times more rapidly than the naturally occurring protein. So, so at this point, we began to think that the folding rate, what was determining the folding rate of proteins, was something that wasn't going to be highly sensitive to the details of the sequence, and had to be, and was likely to be some a lower resolution property of the protein. And we started thinking about very simple models for protein folding. And I think you've heard about some of these models already here. The simplest model you could think of, Go-type model, is one in which you have a free energy landscape which is dominated by the trade-off between the formation of of attractive native interactions and loss of chain configurational entropy. And in the simplest possible model you might think of, all contacts all native interactions are equal in energy, and the free energy of ordering different segments is the same as long as they have the same length. So this is sort of a completely homogeneous model. And in this type of model, I'm not going to go through it in detail, but just give you a simple example. So the question is, how is this trade-off, what's going to determine how the trade-off between the formation of attractive interactions and the loss in chain entropy? Well, if you consider this sort of this schematic of a protein here, if the contacting residues in the three-dimensional structure are close along the sequence, then as the protein folds, as segments get ordered, attractive interactions are made more or less simultaneously, and so the loss in entropy associated with ordering the segment is compensated for by the formation of attractive interactions. Whereas in this type of protein here, this high contact order protein, residues that are making contacts in a three-dimensional structure may be separated by a very large fraction of the chain. And so to make this contact requires ordering, or at least constraining, this large intervening segment of the chain. And so you have a much larger barrier. There's the free energy cost of forming this contact is much higher than the free energy cost of this forming this contact. And if you work out a simple model like this, what you find is that that folding rates in this completely isotropic model do depend on what the average sequence separation between contacting residues is. So this contact order, which I'll talk more about in a moment, is simply the average sequence separation between residues in the native structure. So here, the contact order will be relatively low. Here, it would be relatively high. And so when Kevin Plaxico was in the group, he looked at fortunately, there's been a lot of experimental studies on proteins of many different sequences and functions and folds. And Kevin collected data from the literature. Each one of these data points is a different protein. And this on the x-axis is the contact order, which is computed from the known structures of these proteins. And this is the log of the folding rate. And what you find is, what you see is, in fact, this correlation between contact order and the folding rate. So proteins that have primarily local contacts, like that protein, the schematic I had showed on the left on my previous slide, these proteins fold rapidly, whereas proteins that have high contact order fold more slowly. And this is rather remarkable because these proteins have, like I said, completely different folds and functions and sequences, yet the single parameter really captures a reasonable amount, not obviously there's scatter around this line, but a reasonable amount of the variation is captured by this contact order parameter.
When you make mutations in a given structure and get back the same structure, you shouldn't change the contact order.
That's right. So there's certainly... Right, we have to look on what the range is. Here we have 6 or 7 orders of magnitude. So if you make mutations, you almost never change the folding rate by more than 2 orders of magnitude. And you can see there is scatter. I mean, there's certainly other effects. I mean, so there's a scatter of at least 2 orders of magnitude that would correspond to what you get by changing the sequence.
Is this log-based thing?
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so there are a couple puzzles. Right, so the contact order here is right. So there are a couple puzzles here. First of all, this is expressed as a percent of total length, and this is one of the puzzles. When Henri visited, what?
The average total.
Yeah, so you simply take a structure, you determine the number of the sequence separation between all pairs of contacting residues, and you average that, you divide by the length. Okay. A contact, it's really very robust to how you define it. This is just there are 2 side chain atoms that contact.
Distance,
let's see, I think it's 2 side chain atoms are within 4 or 5 angstroms, 4 angstroms. 6, okay, we'll see.
What are the symbols?
Yeah, okay, so the different symbols are just different secondary structure classes. The circles are alpha helical proteins, which have lower contact order, they have more local contacts. The squares are beta sheet proteins. the diamonds are mixed alpha-beta proteins, and the triangles are actually, the triangles are proteins from the same family, family studied by Chris Dobson and co-workers, that they all have the same overall fold, but they have loops of different lengths. And so the point of showing these broken down by categories, you can see within each of these classes, this correlation holds up. That's an alpha beta.
What's the length variation?
The length variation here is the largest. It's probably about from about 60 or 50 amino acids to 120 or 130 amino acids. These are all proteins that fold with a simple two-state way without any detectable intermediates. Well, okay. So, what happens if you do that? So, this is really for Henri, who was wondering when he visited why this wasn't really the logarithm of the contact order. Because after all, that's the loop. The entropic cost of forming a loop is really more closely related to the log. Is proportional to the logarithm rather than the absolute. And just the point is that with this limited range, there's not really any difference. But here's the puzzle. If you look at the absolute contact order rather than the relative contact order, the correlation is much worse. So there is a puzzle here. Why does the relative contact order do much better? One possible explanation is that that it introduces stability in sort of an indirect way. If we go back to this plot, more stable proteins do fold more rapidly. If you stabilize a protein, it will fold more rapidly. You're at least partially stabilizing, on average anyway, the interactions in the folding transition state. So longer proteins in this set are somewhat more stable than the shorter proteins. So when you divide by the length, you're accounting for the effects of stability in, albeit a somewhat indirect way. There may be other explanations. Well, I consider this a puzzle. Do you have any explanation?
If you multiply by m to the power of 2/3, we have done this with Kevin just several days ago. For small proteins, you have absolutely the same correlation as you have now. But for longer, we have much better correlation.
Okay, so rather than dividing by the length...
So you divide by length in the power of 1/3.
Okay, all right.
So it just gives you a possibility to go to longer proteins.
Yeah, but now do you have a physical justification for this?
And to the power of 2/3, yes.
For the
paper,
and I think
we need to talk about that.
Okay. Yeah, well.
You could divide it by n to the power of alpha and just alpha.
Yeah. That's right. Okay, now I do remember that now. So. All right. Now, here actually, I made a mistake. We had made this observation now that the folding rates really seem to depend just on this very low resolution structure of the protein, this topology. So you could just look at a protein structure and not worry about any of the details of the interactions, and predict what the folding rate. And so the guess was then that, and there was experimental data to support this at the beginning, that you could also, but the same was true for the protein folding mechanism. You could also predict what the order of events in the folding process, which structural elements formed at which times, was also dependent on the overall topology of the protein and not so much on the details. And I think I was wrong about this. It turned out that the details do matter when one gets into the question of how what the order of events in the folding process is. Okay, so to summarize so far, the magnitude of the free energy barrier to folding protein folding rates are largely determined by the native state topology, because this really determines the trade-off between the formation of attractive interactions and the loss of configurational entropy. However, what recent data has shown is there may be several alternative routes to the native structure that have roughly equal free energy barriers. And it turns out that to account for protein folding mechanisms, to explain what's going on, you need to also consider these inhomogeneities, the different variations in the contact or energies and variations in the local free energies of ordering. So the sorts of things that we we need to, the additional details we need to add to actually explain how a protein folds up. For the contact energy, we now say it's proportional to the buried surface area. The free energy of ordering depends on what the backbone torsional angles are. So there are clearly cases of backbone strain in proteins. And finally, hydrogen bonding also consider hydrogen bonding patterns. Okay, so you've already described your model for things. So I'm going to go through this quickly. So we developed a couple years ago a simple model for folding free energy landscapes, which turned out to be very similar to a model developed in Alexey's group. So I'll go through this rather quickly, and I think I'll mainly talk about the newer things that we've been doing here. So we wanted to have a simple model that we want to now predict not what the folding rate is, but what the order, what the folding nucleus is going to be, what parts of the protein are going to be ordered at the rate-limiting step. So in this model, which is a GO model, each residue is either completely ordered, or it's either completely disordered, or it's ordered as in the native structure. And the ordered residues, when they're ordered, interact as they do in the native structure. Again, the important feature of all these models is that non-native interactions are completely ignored. The ordered residues are restricted to one or two contiguous segments. Actually, now Alexey's model, original model, had three segments, and we've also done this with three segments. This is just to restrict the size, reduce the number of configurations one has to consider. Obviously, if there aren't restrictions on the number of which residues are ordered and which ones aren't, then one has a very large number of possible configurations to consider, because each residue can either be ordered or disordered. And the free energy of each configuration is a balance between the attractive native interactions and the unfavorable entropy of ordering. So in the latest models, the attractive native interactions are modeled through the surface area buried and hydrogen bonding, and the unfavorable entropy of ordering, the entropic cost is there's an entropic cost to closing a loop in a chain, an entropic cost to ordering a residue, and then an additional term for local backbone strain. So in this model, you can enumerate all possible configurations. That's the advantage of this restriction to one, two, or three contiguous segments. You can enumerate all possible configurations and compute their free energies. So essentially, one has the whole free energy landscape for this simplified model of a protein. And then Alexey had a very elegant dynamic programming method to identify the lowest free energy paths. What we did was you've got this whole landscape, and now to model dynamics on this landscape, the rule is that you can only order or disorder a single residue at the time. So that describes the kinetic connectivity between all these different configurations. And now, we use a fairly simple algorithm to identify the lowest free energy path from the unfolded state to the folded state, and then to identify what the high points on these low free energy paths were. And that's the transition state ensemble for the model.
One of your papers, you assumed a zipper model where you only had once you formed one contact, it had to zipper up.
Yeah, actually, there's
that's no longer the case.
For this model, like I said, the terms are, that's sort of true, because there's an entropic term for closing a loop. But now as you add on, suppose you bring two residues together to close a loop, there's an entropic cost, which is sort of goes like the logarithm of the loop length. But now you make the next contact and the next one. You don't pay that entropic cost again. You only pay it once. So in a sense, that's
so
there.
It's implicit
in the model, right?
But you have an ordering.
What?
You have
an extra ordering cost. So you pay for ordering that residue, but you don't pay for the loop again.
So when you say continuous segments, do you mean continuous segments along the
same? Yeah, that's right.
So if I form a contact there, then I have ordered, disordered, ordered.
Yes.
And so I cannot form, for instance, two loops simultaneously.
Let's see, it probably be easier if I drew a picture. Is there some place that I can draw? Okay. Let's see. Actually, maybe why don't you draw the picture of what you're thinking of? That might be the easiest thing.
So if I have a section here where I have some loop close, some loop close,
Yeah. So there, this will be the simplest type of, this will be two segments and then some disordered intervening loop.
Right, so if I have something like boom, boom.
Okay, so. And then another pair of interacting segments here, you mean?
Right.
Right, so this isn't allowed. The problem is that you have two to the end configurations, right? And so we want to enumerate all of them, evaluate their free energies. Three, you can do, have you gone up to, you've done four as well, right? Yeah.
Five,
yeah.
And just take the random combination of these. So 2 to the power. And we have n about 20. 2 to the power of 20 is just still feasible.
Yeah.
The results are essential at this
stage. Yeah.
So this is not feasible.
Yeah.
But that means that you form a contact and then you can zipper up and down that contact. And that's what it means to zippering up and down the contact once it's formed and then you get the whole loop order.
Right. So, in fact, even in the two-segment model, what can happen is these two segments can order. They zip together, and then you can order another segment here. So we've done the problem that we've had. The problem is once you go to three segments, you do have to start chunking things up, and so you lose something there. So it's sort of a trade-off. You can start tunneling through barriers if you chunk it up to things. So basically, the way the model works is you start off with everything completely disordered, and then you order one residue, and then you might order another residue. And when these two residues order, they're assumed to interact as they are in the native state. So now basically you can enumerate all possible configurations here. And then the rule is, as I said, that you can only, the only things that are have that are differ by one in the number of residues ordered are connected. So then you have this very complicated graph. And the algorithmic problem, which is fairly easy to solve, is to find the lowest free energy path, the path from the fully unfolded state to the fully folded state, which would be represented like this, which crosses over the lowest free energy barrier.
So every time you add a new ordered state,
yeah,
you assume that it is paired with some unpaired ordered state in the system.
If in the native structure, right, so if the native structure looks like this, so if the protein I'm trying to predict the structure, predict the folding mechanism of, is just a hairpin. Suppose I start by ordering this residue first. That I pay a penalty of 1.5 kcals for ordering. Now, if the next residue I order is this residue here, I have twice that entropic cost plus an entropy for this loop here. But if the next one I order is here, then I get the interactions back that it makes in the native structure. So the problem. So this basically lets me introduce the structure, albeit at low resolution.
And so once a segment is ordered, it never gets disordered.
No, it can get disordered. There's no. You can go. It's everything is in equilibrium, so things can go back and forth. All right. I think. How do I put this down? Are there any other questions on this? So, in the original model. In the original model, the free energy cost of ordering each residue was a constant, and the only attractive term was this term that was proportional to the free energy. And I've said what we've done more recently is to add additional terms. And let me first go to the experimental data, which really forced us to do this. Okay, so first I'll explain how we got fooled to some extent. So if you look on the right, that's the first. This is experimental data. These are the so-called phi-value distributions. Red indicates that a residue is ordered, or at least somewhat ordered, making favorable interactions at the rate-limiting step in folding. Whereas blue means that the interactions made by that residue are formed after the rate-limiting step in folding. So, in my group, this protein was studied. In Luis Serrano's group, this protein was studied, and what was very evident and very interesting was that this hairpin here, you can see, is colored red in both structures. So for both these proteins, which have only 30%, 70% of the amino acids are different, yet they seem to have the same portion of the structure that's ordered at the rate-limiting step in folding. And so this was part of the reason that we hypothesized that really the overall structure of the protein really determined not only the folding rate, but also the order in which the protein folded up. But subsequent results show that this wasn't true. Generally, when you go a little bit further away in the family, this is a protein recently characterized in Louis Serrano's lab, SSO, and this is a protein characterized in my lab called PSAE. When you go a little further away, you now see that there are differences. These proteins are, this protein is, has a different part of the structure is ordered in the folding transition state. And why is that? Well, what's happened in this protein is that this turn, which is a very tight turn with lots of favorable hydrogen bonds in these two proteins, now is a 5-glycine, it's a completely disordered loop. So there were favorable interactions in this turn in these two proteins, but not in this protein. So, as I said, we've put in these very simple things into the model, and the model calculations are shown on the left. Again, so this is, you basically do this model I've described, and now you simply look at the frequency, you collect these transition states, which are the highest points on the lowest free energy paths, and the red are residues which are ordered in these transition state configurations, and blue are residues which are on average not ordered. And you can see the model does a reasonable job at recapitulating the experimental data.
Some kind of more formal estimate of how reasonable the job in terms of correlation between predicted and...
Yeah, in a quantitative value, it's not very good, right? It's not very good. The correlation coefficients are probably on the round 0.5. So they're very... I would say the correlation coefficients are poor.
They'll have kind of the plot detailing where you do good and where you do not good. Because that would be very interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
No numbers, but... to see where the predictions...
where it fails.
Where they fail, because they will give a pretty interesting structure in a specific way.
That's a really good idea. No, we haven't done that. As we do these experiments, we know that there's a lot of problems with the phi-value data, and also these models are so simple that...
Especially in SSO, because in SSO data is problematic in this loop, because voltages are very low.
Yeah. In which loop? In that...
SSO. In SSO, yeah. In this loop that...
Yeah. This loop here?
Yeah. The data are quite problematic because of delta 0.2.
I see. Okay, yeah, I didn't realize that. I actually don't think I even saw what the... Oh, the paper just came out. I guess Lewis sent us the data long before he sent us the paper.
I sent us the data as well, and I saw the data before, and I wrote him the conclusion that he's making. Yeah. I'm not sure because all differences between Victrine and the SSO are on... residues was delta G very low, so you should rather look.
I should look,
detail in the data on SSO.
Yeah, for me it's kind
you
of...
can't bring your PSA data, but SSO data.
The PSAE data are not so good either, actually. Yeah, no, it's a very good point. I guess one reason why we haven't looked in detail where we go wrong is because... I guess there's a question... I don't know how much I believe these simple models should be able to get things right at this level. And also because, as you say, the experimental data isn't good. But that is really good. Maybe there is a systematic problem, a systematic thing, yeah. The correlation coefficients are not very good. I mean, they look reasonable in terms of these overall pictures, but... now, there are larger proteins, like Barnet's... these are, again, the experimental data. So these two proteins, you can sort of very clearly look at the native structure and see that they're sort of compact subdomains, which are... which are the parts that are ordered to the transition state. And these type of proteins are not very difficult for the model to get correct, because I think here the topology really is what's... There really is a better... I mean, would you agree with that? I mean, there's...
why you can simply predict by compactness of local environment.
Yeah.
We did this analysis on the papers coming out.
Yeah.
And about half the proteins you can predict by values by local compactness.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Why is a good example?
Yeah. I think Barnet's is like that to some extent too.
Barnet's.
Yeah. So I think that proteins are really varying in there. These bigger proteins with subdomains are any model would basically get right. Now, okay, what I really want to focus on now are these two proteins, which are the other. I agree with you. I mean, the SH3 case, I don't really know very well. But here's a clear case, protein G and protein L, where this overall structures are the same. So it's a four-stranded sheet with a helix.
So the general idea, which is physically very reasonable, is you have a dense core, implies those are likely to have larger, quote-unquote, 5 hours.
Well, if you think about this simple model, you're asking basically if I want to put together this three-dimensional structure in a way that I get the most favorable interactions as I lose entropy, what I should probably do is order this dense region subdomain first, and then order the rest, because the entropy cost of ordering will be paid for by the making the favorable interactions as you go. So I think it's very physically intuitive.
So is there a sufficient confidence in this relation such that you could say that the accessible surface area or so and so the phi is expected to be
Well, let's see, the phi value, you can have residues that are very highly buried but are often in regions that are very, very distant from the rest of the chain, and those will have low phi values probably.
But this is a general statistical expectation.
Yeah, we haven't really looked at that all that much. That would be an interesting thing to look at. Okay, so now if you look at these two proteins, here, this protein, these are both proteins that were characterized in my lab, and this was sort of, this is what was saying that in some sense I was wrong, sort of staring me in the face, because here these two proteins have the same overall structure, but here this protein, it seems that the first hairpin is what's ordered at the rate limiting step, whereas in this protein it's the second beta hairpin which is ordered. So you have very similar proteins, very similar structures, but they seem to fold up in an opposite manner. And now if you add these extra terms, if you look at the structures, you can start to see what might be going on. This hairpin in protein G has extensive hydrogen bonding, and in fact is stable in isolation. And so this is the lower free energy turn in protein G. In protein L, this second turn has a lot of torsional strain. So just looking at it, one can sort of, if you look at these structures in detail, you can start to understand why there might be a difference in the order with which the different elements fold up. Yeah. Yeah, their functions are to bind antibodies. They're bacterial proteins on the surface of the protein, on the surface of the cell, and they soak up antibodies. They use the same part. Yeah, they're similar. Their sequences are complete. These are extremely. There's no similarity in the sequences of these two proteins. So the simple model can capture to some extent the difference. So in protein L, this first hairpin is predicted to fold first. In protein G, the second hairpin. So the message from this is that proteins with, if you have a three-dimensional structure that has some symmetry,
I understand the thing.
Yeah.
What did you describe was like it's pretty
global. Yeah.
The structure is the same.
Right, but now what I've said is that there's what we've added to it are some terms which are specific terms. So hydrogen bonding and torsional strain are the two terms that we've added. So there, as I said, this turn is it's through the surface area term. So the favorable, so the surface area, hydrogen bonding, and torsional strain. No, they're proportional. The proportional to the surface area buried between the two residues. So what you can see very clearly, even looking at the experimental data, is if the structure has a fair amount of symmetry. You see, you've got the helix, and you've got a hairpin, then a helix, and another hairpin. If there's a lot of symmetry, then there can really be different routes to the native state. You can either form this hairpin first as in protein G, or this hairpin first as in protein L. And what's going to determine the difference between these two, it really just has to depend on details, because from a purely topological level, they're equivalent. And I think the danger of these type of models is that you always have a limited data set, and you have human ingenuity, which is a real problem. So that you can parameterize the model so you get the right answer. So in my opinion, I mean, really, it'll require, we want to make lots of predictions and see how well they're upheld, because it's all too easy to fit a model, even with a small number of parameters, to get the answer right. But anyway, so that's why, this is nice, but we knew the answer before we started. Yeah?
In the model here, when you say that you find this in a large portion of the distance.
Say that again?
On the modeling,
yeah.
In the red fraction of these proteins,
yeah.
You find those parts structured in a large fraction of the
distance. Yes.
How big is that fraction? Is that extensive?
Oh, you mean in the experimental data or the computer, the model? Okay. Yeah, I think red means that a dark red color probably means on the order of 80-90%. I think here we're taking the top 100 transition state configurations. Okay, so now the hypothesis that you'd have then, based on this type of experimental data, is that for proteins for which there are several alternative routes that are more or less topologically equivalent to the native structure, it's the lower free energy route which is the one that's preferred. So in each protein, we can understand this at least qualitatively, based on simply using the simple idea that the lowest free energy path will involve the formation of the lowest free energy structural elements. Okay, so now, and then like I said, we get this part roughly correct. Okay, but now we want to really test this, and the way that we tested this hypothesis was to use computational protein design methods. And has there been much discussion of, did you talk about protein design at all? Okay, so let me give you an overview of, there are a number of groups who've developed models like this. I'll just tell you briefly about our model. The potential function, so here this is the problem is, given a structure, find the best sequence, the lowest free energy sequence for that structure. So the potential function is a standard Leonard-Jones potential, an implicit solvent model, hydrogen bonding, and the way that this problem can be made computationally tractable takes advantage of the fact that if you look at amino acid side chains in protein structures, they occur in only a relatively small number of discrete rotamer conformations. So the small residues may only have on the order of three different conformations, large residues up to 10 or 20. So you can actually enumerate all the likely configurations of each side chain. And the potential function we use is pair additive. So what this lets us do is pre-compute the interaction energies between all pairs of residues up front. And then a very simple Monte Carlo search lets us identify very low free energy sequences for that structure. So one of the first results we got with this, which is a little bit off the track here in my talk, but is that if you find the best possible sequence for 108 naturally occurring proteins, about 30% of the amino acids are identical to the residue in the native sequence. So in some sense, what this says is that particularly in the core, in the packing part, the native arrangements of amino acids are optimal in some sense. So basically what I want to say though is, given a structure, now we can compute what, at least according to the potential function of the model, which obviously isn't perfect, we can compute what the optimal sequence is.
Can you repeat more precisely what you do exactly? Random
mutations? Let's see. Yeah, random. They're random Monte Carlo and sequence space.
With the
right.
Fixed composition?
This is not with fixed composition, no. The structure.
Yeah, sure. No, but what do you optimize? Energy?
Yeah, I'm optimizing the energy, right.
So why don't you get over
polynomial? Because you have a structure which has an interior and an exterior. So on the exterior, there's a solvation term in here. So on in the core, you'll have nonpolar amino acids. On the surface, you'll have polar amino acids. This Leonard-Jones potential is very important. So in the core, you need tight packing, and so what the optimal solution will be very different from a homopolymer. It looks like a jigsaw puzzle.
Why won't you find, say, polyvalent or polyolysin?
Well, in the core?
In the core, yeah. Why?
Well, because it's got to pack. It's got to pack well. So the lowest free energy set of side chains will be ones that make are very close packed but non-overlapping.
Do you use some kind of mean field thing to adjust the side chain surface? Why do you not have a homopolymer surface?
Well, no, that's right. So on the surface, you don't get a homopolymer because there's hydrogen bonding. There's a hydrogen bonding term, and also different parts of the surface. It's not completely exposed. If you had a site which was completely exposed and made no interactions, all those sites should be filled by the same amino acid.
Yes.
But I think there's still a chance of memorization of the sequence by encoding the structure. So, for instance,
yeah.
if I came to
yes.
Felix,
yes, 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 absolutely, 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 right, right. So that's really. That's really the question. Actually, we had a paper on this, the summer in PNAS, which is really all on that question. To what extent is the sequence really encoded in the structure in exactly that way? And I think that's certainly part of it. The way we got around that problem was to include NMR structures from NMR calculations. So you have a large, even when you include an ensemble of conformations, the crystal structure gives you the lowest free energy sequence, and that sequence is most similar to the native structure. That's a little bit of a subtlety. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
You start your Monte Carlo simulation
yes.
from what?
From a random sequence.
From a random sequence.
Yeah, okay. Right. And if you start with different random sequences, you get more or less the same solution. Yeah.
Do you try to optimize the sidechain packet or not?
Yes, that's in the Leonard Jones term. That's.
But do you do it by some kind of procedure like mean field?
No, actually, it turns out that the mean field doesn't work as well in this case. So we've tried doing mean field calculations. It's and the Monte Carlo is fast enough so that you can really do it. So it's just you have some number of rotamers for each core residue, and you obviously throw out at the beginning the rotamers that interact with the backbone. I should say that Steve Mayo at Caltech has really done a lot of work with this type of model. He's used the dead end elimination theorem to make the search faster. But we found that Monte Carlo worked quite efficiently. Okay, so now let's come back to protein L and protein G. Now we have a method for doing protein design, and we have this hypothesis that for these proteins, it's the lower free energy, the hairpins, that's going to fold first. So what we want to do is take protein L, in which the first hairpin folds more.
But you're not sure that the final structure is the naked structure of the mutated protein.
Right, right. Okay, so let me just show you what I'll show you the data for protein L. So. I told you that, let's see, which one do I want to show you first? So this is that second turn in protein L. The blue one is the wild type one, and this is highly kinked. There are three residues, consecutive residues, that have positive phi angles. So I told you that we had hypothesized that the reason this turn folded first, folded second, folded late, was because of the strain involved here. So we redesigned the protein, we removed this kink, extended the beta hairpin. To say this, all the computational, the program in this design was all done by Brian Kuhlman, who's a really fantastic postdoc in my lab now. And so we redesigned this hairpin, and then actually made a protein that had that redesigned hairpin, and solved the crystal structure. And so what we had, so basically we replaced this hair, what we wanted to do turned out, what we were aiming for turned out to be very close to what actually happened. So we changed the sequence so as to make this hairpin better, make an optimal hairpin here using this design procedure, and then we solved the structure. And one of these is what we were trying to make, and the other one is the actual crystal structure, which we subsequently determined. So now we've been able to make a protein L that doesn't have this kinked turn, we've done the same thing with protein G. Take the beta hairpin, which was not formed at the rate limiting step, and use this design procedure to try and make it an optimal beta turn. And we were very excited to see that this is for the protein G case. That so this is just a standard equilibrium denaturation plot of the wild type protein. Here, so this protein denatures at about 3 molar guanidine, corresponds to about 4 kcals per mole stability. After redesigning the turn, the stability is dramatically increased. So these numbers should be taken with a grain of salt, but it's at least several kcals more stable. So the first message is that we can take a naturally occurring protein and really improve on it by re-engineering a beta hairpin. So now we've produced these proteins that have re-engineered beta hairpins, which are much more stable, and we can ask how they fold. And so this is protein G. This is the first hairpin, then the helix, and the second hairpin. And remember, I told you that in protein G, the second hairpin is the one that folds is ordered in the transition state in the wild type protein. Okay, so what turns out to be the case is that in the redesigned protein, it's completely switched. So I'll just show you, go through these two curves because it's really quite dramatic. The wild type is in blue. So this is the folding rate of the wild type and the folding. So this column is the wild type protein G. This column is the redesigned protein G, the one with that hairpin change. So the blue is the design protein here, or the wild type protein G here. If we make a mutation in the second beta turn in red, in the wild type that drastically decreases the folding rate. Whereas if we make a mutation in the first beta turn, it has virtually no effect on the folding rate. In this redesigned protein, it's switched. So now when we make a mutation in the first beta turn, the folding rate drops. When we make a mutation in the second beta turn, and there's no effect. So we've actually, by this redesign process, we've been able to switch the protein from folding with the second hairpin first to now folding with the first hairpin first. And that, and we've done that by stabilizing the beta hairpin. Actually, the overall folding, we cheated. We actually not only stabilized this hairpin, but we crippled that one. The redesigned protein actually folds about 100 times faster. And you see the same switch in the unfolding rates, but I don't think I'll really go into it. So,
how much of the switch in the mechanism was due to helping Green and for
that's a hard question to answer. It's certainly much more than the redesign is. If you just hurt, I think if in the experiments in both protein L protein G, if you just hurt the good one, it doesn't switch. If you, so it's probably some combination.
But there's another question. Why do you interpret these results and similar results in terms of which hairpin forms first, which hairpin first left? By mutation, by effect of mutation on folding rate, right?
Yeah.
But mutation affects, I mean, what you see is the rate limiting step.
Yeah, that's, I'm speaking loosely. The changing what's ordered at the rate limiting step from being primarily the second hairpin to being primarily the first hairpin. Right, thanks.
In general, there's a pathway, if you have both pathways, it could happen on different statistics. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's obviously...
I think that's exactly what's going on here. You see, we have... And I think that's why we still get this good correlation with contact order, you see, because both these paths both will have roughly the same barrier height. And so by doing these making these perturbations on the sequence of the design, we can change their... And so what you see...
Both things may be going on.
Right. Well, I think undoubtedly they are going on at the same time.
That's exactly what I reported yesterday. We did a lot of simulation on protein G, and two pathways are in parallel, but one is dominant and another is...
You should do it on the redesign. Could you do it on the redesign sequence?
Of course,
sequence?
We haven't done it yet.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly what's going on. And that's what happens if we don't hurt the good one. We get both. You know, so it's more 50-50. Yeah.
You need to put your results in the redesign protein is better. But if you actually change the papyrus so that it produces the redesign protein.
Yeah, we change the sequence of the.
Is it more efficiently?
Is it made more efficiently? I don't know.
I mean, is it really better for the organism?
Oh, we didn't do an actual functional test. It probably would be worse because there probably are, probably by changing this hairpin. I suspect it would be worse because this hairpin has some unusual properties. It has all this strain, and that's probably because it's important in the function of the protein. So probably we've made it a more stable protein, but we've probably lost some of its functional characteristics. That would be my bet, but we haven't done any functional tests. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. If you help the green, you speed up the folding rate by a factor of 100.
Yeah.
Yet the new pattern, but you... finding that it's going about 50-50, half going green, half going red, which means that the red path should be sped up by about a factor of 50 also, by stabilizing the green path.
Well, you see, it's complicated when you make these mutations, right? Because the way we're getting our readout is we're making mutations. Uh-huh. Now, those mutations themselves are going to be changing the, you know, in cases where there are two paths that are fairly close in the free energy, when we make the mutation, we may be changing the paths I think it can get fairly complicated.
Right. It sounds like the redesigning of the green loop is speeding up the red folding path substantially. If
Yeah, I think we're getting into subtleties a little bit, just because, again, the way that we're reading this out is by then subsequently making another mutation on top of it and looking at the effect on the folding rate. So, I mean, yes, I certainly see what you're saying, and it's, yeah. Yeah.
If you want to speak like 1.5 hour, then you
yeah.
take a break. If you
have, just I have half an hour still, okay, so I didn't get to the main event.
Yeah. You discuss during lunchtime and afternoon, and let the speaker talk.
Hopefully not too much. All right, so where was I? All right, so... So the results I've showed you so far sort of all together suggest that that for some structures there will be different routes that will have roughly free energies, and that these differences can to some extent be captured by adding more detailed features to the energy functions in these simple folding models, and also allow one to re-engineer the folding route by these sort of birational design methods. There's one more thing that also can be done here. A structure of a protein L mutant was determined by Jason O'Neill and Cam Zhang, Fred Hutchinson in Seattle. What they noticed is that two of the protein L monomers in this crystal actually were swapped. So the strand. So this is that second turn, which had this very kinked, this is for the wild-type protein, or the wild-type turn, and this very kinked conformation. And what happened in this crystal is that strain was relieved by just having the strand keep going straight and go into a second monomer.
This is the mutant.
This is what?
The crystal, the main structure of the mutant.
This is of a mutant, right. That's right. So in this crystal, it's kind of amazing. There were four monomers in the asymmetric unit. Two were domain swapped and two weren't. Okay. So in solution, it's purely monomeric. This is an artifact of the high concentration in the crystal. Okay. But now we have, so this gave us the idea then that we should also be able to re-engineer the sequence so as to make the normally monomeric protein an obligate dimer. So we use this structure and put it into our design calculations, and here's that protein. Here's a crystal structure. It's been re-engineered so this loop sequence now is compatible with this straight stretch and incompatible with the turn. This protein is an obligate dimer even at low concentrations. The dissociation constant is picomolar, 100 picomolar. So by redesigning the sequence, we can change a monomeric protein into a dimer. It's again the same type of principle. And so that is all I'm going to say about studies of about protein folding mechanisms and design. And I'm just going to summarize what I've told you. Protein folding rates are largely determined by the topology of the native state. The contact order, and you saw this with the contact order relationship, because several alternative routes to the native state may have roughly equal free energy barriers, folding pathways also depend on these heterogeneities in the contact and ordering free energies. And this is what allows us then to re-engineer folding mechanisms. So we can predict to some extent how proteins fold using simple computational models. If I were you, I would take this with a grain of salt after all, because we had a limited data set. And so we really want to, I tell the graduate student who's working on this that he can't leave before he's made lots and lots of predictions so that we'll really know whether the model works or not. We can, to some extent, redesign folding mechanisms and oligomerization states by changing the free energies of formation of local structural elements. Okay, so now, I'm going to talk about, so I haven't addressed at all the problem of, given the amino acid sequence, predict the three-dimensional structure. And what I've told you is, if you give me the sequence of the protein and the three-dimensional structure, I can tell you how it folds up. I can look, but I always require the native structure in these calculations, because after all these models are basically GO-type models. Okay, so now, we want to we want to actually have a method for predicting protein structure from amino acid sequence. And these are sort of the insights from the experimental work that have gone into this method, which is called Rosetta. The first insight is that local interactions bias, but do not uniquely determine the conformation sampled by short segments of the chain. And so each, in this picture of folding, each portion of the chain is sampling different local structures, which have different free energies, which depend on the local sequence. And then passing over the free energy barrier to folding requires orientation of these local segments so as to bury the hydrophobic residues and pair the beta strands and so forth. Then ultimately, stability is determined by the details of the side chain interactions. But at least to locate the topology at the native topology at low resolution, we can do this at a lower resolution level. And I'm going to get to how contact order ties into this in just a moment. So we want to simulate the folding of the protein, and we need to then model this flickering of the local segments of the sequence in between different types of local structures. And the obvious way to do this would be to come up with a force field that recapitulates the differences in the free energies of different local configurations. And in our experience, the current force fields are really not up to this task because they depend on quite subtle details. So instead, we use the following sort of more empirical approach. For each segment of 9 residues in the protein that we're trying to fold up, we basically make the approximation that the distribution of structures this segment would sample in solution is reasonably well approximated by the distribution of structures you see for that sequence in known solved 3-dimensional protein structures. So to make that more concrete, for residues 1 through 9 in this protein, the true structure shown on top, that we don't know, but we assume that the distribution of states that this sequence would adopt if free in solution is given by what's shown here, and those are the structures of the most closely related sequences in the protein data bank. So then for each... Yeah.
For an average 9-mer, how likely are you to find 8% of the database?
Well, you can compute what it is. We're using a substitution table. And so it's there's obviously a trade-off here. As you go longer, there's more information, but the database is less well represented. So, yeah, I mean,
these are reasonably high.
Yeah, it's probably about 50%. Okay, so. These are all from different proteins. So I was showing you what the lists look like. Okay, so this sort of now will define our search space for folding up this protein. What we need to do is to choose a configuration off these lists. That when combined makes a reasonable protein 3-dimensional structure that has non-local interactions, has the hydrophobic residues buried and has the beta strands paired.
And how long are the lists typically?
In this case, they're 25. Yeah.
It's a similar local sequence, so it doesn't
have to be exactly. Right, right. That's right.
What's the variation?
They go down to about 50%.
Separate segments are overlapping.
They're overlapping, yeah. This is misleading, so they're nested. So the way one does this is you start off just by randomly choosing, you start off with a fully extended chain, and now you randomly substitute in these fragments. This is all done in internal coordinates, so the variables are the backbone torsion angles. Each one of these structures is just represented by a list of torsion angles. And so you randomly substitute in these, you randomly pick a position in the chain, and then you randomly pick from the list and substitute in that fragment. And every time you do that, it will generate a new protein structure. Those structures are evaluated using a simple potential function, which, again, primarily has solvation, the hydrophobic effects and strand pairing, obviously excluded volume and so forth. But it's a low-resolution potential. And it's a simple simulated Monte Carlo simulated annealing procedure where you end up doing about 20,000 attempted insertions. An insertion is accepted if the energy decreases. And at the end of after about 20,000 attempted moves, what one is left with is a conformation that looks quite looks very much like a protein. The local structure, see, I have a sort of picture of one way to think about this.
We think that once it gets somewhat compact, changing any local angles, whatever, would be extremely.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So, you're absolutely right. The thing, once the chain collapses, the dynamics slow down drastically. So what turns out to be that what we found to be the most efficient approach is do very, very, very large numbers of independent simulations.
And just short simulations.
Independent short simulations, right. So if you, so.
What kind of model of the chain do you take? Self or self-dissipated?
Full backbone plus sidechain centroid. Yeah. Okay, so for small proteins, we've got single exponential kinetics. So the probability of folding is per unit time is constant. So therefore, so what we do is we do very large numbers of short simulations, and the yield of native structure should be roughly the same as in very long simulations, a small number of long simulations. In practice, because of the freezing, it's more efficient to do many, many short ones. Okay, now there's an artifact you can think of that, remember this folding rate contact order relationship. We're doing very short folding simulations, so you might expect to pile up, to accumulate low contact order structures. And in fact, unfortunately, I don't have an overhead to show you this, but what in fact happens when you generate configurations using this sort of rapid quench thing is you generate very large numbers of very low contact order structures. So there's a parallel between the actual folding process and, at least in this sense, between the actual folding process and the folding, these type of folding simulations. So
any contact, because you don't know what they are.
You don't know what they are, but you know you can compute what the contact order is. Yeah. Okay. So what one does after the fact, so what we do is just to renormalize the contact order distribution simply by generating very large numbers of structures and then removing the very low contact order models that we know that we're producing at too large a level. Okay, I was going to show you this picture. I'm sorry, this is kind of smudgy, but you might think of this as... So the basic feature of this procedure is, if you imagine this to be the space of all configurations which are compatible with the local sequence of the protein, we're always within this space because we're building by construction, because we're building structures from fragments. So every structure we produce will be consistent with the local sequence biases of the structure. So now this is the space of structures that has good non-local interaction, so it's globally low in free energy. And this is the function that we're minimizing by our Monte Carlo simulated annealing procedure. And so what we generate are then structures which are at the intersection of these two spaces. And the native structure we know is here, and what our procedure will work if there aren't too many other structures here. As I said, what we tend to build up are an excess of low contact order structures, and reducing their quantity helps substantially. What we do at the end of the day, after we've generated many, many configurations here, we cluster the structures, and we've found over and over again that the native structure is, while it's not the lowest in free energy, it's generally in one of the largest clusters, which you could interpret as indicating, as being a consequence of the fact that the native minimum is one of the broader, probably the broadest free energy minimum in the free energy landscape.
A question. I can imagine that this could be either very fragile or very robust to the alphabet of local conformations. That you can imagine that if you don't have the right local conformation in your set, then you're not sampling.
Right.
Or I can imagine that the flexibility of the other segments could cover for the missing one.
So we start off with these 9 residue segments. We then switch to 3 residue segments once the chain has collapsed to some extent. And at that point, your representation is guaranteed. And so it turns out to be fairly robust. We haven't seen cases of proteins which don't fold because they aren't represented in the set. Okay, so there's what I'm not going to go into is the fact that if you have additional information from experiments, notably from NMR experiments, you can put that into this procedure and very rapidly produce quite good protein structures. And so we think that using this type of method, we can really speed up, we might be able to really speed up the process of NMR structure determination, because we need much less, we have all this information about proteins in the model, and we only need a relatively small amount of experimental information then to relatively uniquely define the structure. So I won't show you that picture. Okay, so now, when you're developing methods like this, and you know what the final structures are, it's all too easy to again cheat, not really deliberately, but you can parameterize the model so that you get the native structures back. So it's really been critically important to the development of this field is something called a CASP, which is sort of a community-wide experiment to test structure prediction methods. And basically, what's done is structures are collected after NMR spectroscopists and X-ray crystallographers solve structures. There's a group that collects these structures before they're published and then releases their sequences to the community of people who try and predict protein structure. And so then what you're given is on the order of 20 to 40 sequences, and you have to predict their structure before you know what the right answer is, which is really the right way to do it. So we made predictions using this method a couple years ago at the third one of these experiments. And so this is the crystal structure of a protein that binds DNA. This was the true structure, which we didn't know at the time. And this was our predicted structure for that protein. And you can see that a lot of the details are wrong, like this helix bends where it should go straight. And let's see, this is rotated a little bit. But it's clearly got the overall topology correct. And interestingly, from this type of model, you might be able to deduce something about the mechanism by which it bound DNA because of the positioning of these two lobes. So we were able to produce, in some cases, reasonable low-resolution models. Now, since then, yeah, go ahead.
In this particular case, for example, let's say once you are given the correct structure,
yeah,
you stick it into your energy
function. Yeah. Right. That's a good question.
Question number two, does it belong to the same cluster in some sense?
Let's see. The answer to the second question is yes. If you take this model, it's much more similar to the true structure is more similar to this model than it is to any other experimentally determined protein structure. So that this is topologically similar in that sense. The first question is a really important one. And what I want to tell you about briefly is what we've done. This was done actually 2.5 years ago, In the intermediary time, what we've done is to improve the method, and one of the improvements I described was to realize this relationship with contact order. Another improvement was very important work done by Jerry Tsai, who's actually going to be giving a talk tomorrow on this work and what he's really been focusing on, which is the fact that this model, as I said, is this centroid-only model doesn't really... It has the flaw that you just hinted at. Frequently, you get structures that are lower in energy than the native structure, and it's the energy really can't distinguish between different structures. We've always in the past had to use this clustering notion that the biggest cluster would be the most native-like because the energy function wasn't really suitable. So what Jerry's been doing, and he'll tell you about tomorrow, so I'm not going to go into it in detail, is. Okay, yeah, I definitely recommend. He's been using a model similar to what I described for the protein design work, where he takes the structure, the low-resolution structure generated, and now builds on all the side chains, and now does a Monte Carlo procedure where each step he repacks the side chains, and there it turns out that a simple Leonard-Jones his potential function includes Leonard-Jones interaction, solvation potential, and so forth. And I don't really want to say much more of it because I don't want to take away from his talk. But what he finds is that with his potential function, the native structure is almost always the lowest in free energy. And that function now can distinguish to some extent the good structures from the bad structures. No, the backbone's moving too. So it's Monte Carlo on the backbone with repacking of the side chains. No, it wasn't. If you're in a very charitable mood, you might believe that, but that would be, let's say that's a very optimistic interpretation. One just doesn't know. Okay, so now what was really exciting, so this past summer, We got.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I think in a lot of structures you have disorders regions. You have a lot of interest in self-predicting disorders regions and things like that. Have you tried to use this method to predict proteins? What happens when there is a large disordered region?
Yeah.
Is it the type of thing that you get inconclusive results, or does it say, yes, this is actually the correct structure?
That's a really good question, and it's a very important question as we start to apply this method on a large scale and sort of a practical application sort of way. I mean, obviously what we'd like to do is now go through genomes and predict structures. The problem is that we've primarily been generating structures for proteins of known structure, and if it has a big disordered region, then there won't be a known structure for it. So that's...
Even loops and things like that that are disordered.
Yeah.
Or
It's not something that we've looked at systematically, but it's a really good idea. I should write that one down. And what? Oh, you have to go to Jerry's. Jerry has a histogram which shows the distribution of scores and. There were no other predictions that were, the other predictions were just for little pieces. There are these methods called threading or fold recognition, and they would have totally failed because they're proteins that have these three helices, but there's nothing that that has anything like this topology.
And overall, how do you score?
It's best by far.
If you go to Jerry's talk tomorrow, he'll show a histogram which answers that question. But these models were. These all the models I'm going to show you were the best models produced. We had this method work pretty well 2 years ago, but what was really amazing were the models from this last time around. So there were actually 40 proteins that were collected by the organizers. 20 of them were homologous to proteins of known structure. So we basically modified sort of homology-based methods for structure prediction using these ideas and built models using for those 20. And I'm not going to talk about those. But those actually turned out to be really good predictions too. We developed some new alignment methods. But what I'm going to tell you about are the predictions for proteins that were not homologous to anything that was previously known. And these predictions turned out to be pretty amazing. So I'm just going to run through some pictures now. This is for a protein that's important in signaling. And here I'm showing the predicted model and the true structure on top of each other. And you can see now we're getting a much more complex protein reasonably right. The only real problem here is that this helix is shifted over. Now this gets at the question about disordered regions. I don't understand why we got this part right. I should say that this protein, no, we did say this protein had 10 cysteines, and we guessed they would be tied up in disulfide bonds. So we extensively filtered the structures not only for reasonable contact orders, but also for having four or five disulfide bonds, and that may have accounted for getting these sorts of things right. I'll just run through some of these.
So you said you had two improvements since the first.
There was Jerry Tsai's work, which he's going to talk about tomorrow, which is the full atom refinement. There was the realization of this contact order catastrophe. And I'm going to get back to that in a moment. And aside from that, there were, you know, it's just a number of number of sort of. Yes.
How many proteins will be ensemble of proteins for which homology?
Fragments. Yeah. Yeah. A very large number, because on average every segment, probably for this protein, most of the segments were from alpha helical proteins, but when we look, there's a very, very. Right. They were scattered all about, and they had no overall homology to this protein, because we only use this procedure when there does not exist a protein that's homologous, right? So the fragments that we're picking up, don't come from evolutionarily related proteins. What you can, like I said, the way that, I think the way to think about it is that the we're using, what we want to do for each segment of the chain is to get sort of, we'd like to know what the energy levels of the different local conformations are. We'd like to know what states does this segment populate in isolation. And we use the protein database to, as an approximation to that. But it's not, these things are not evolutionarily related. Okay, so. C-alphas. Yeah. Now, you know, the RMSD is a problem because you run into funny things like N's causing trouble. So there was also, one of the proteins was an 811 residue protein, which obviously this type of method runs into problems when you get to larger proteins. But we were able to inspect a multiple sequence alignment, sort of the evolutionary family for this protein, and see that there were actually five distinct subdomains, or we guessed that there were five distinct domains, and that actually turned out to be true. So for many of these domains, we made reasonable predictions. This is, I think, for the second domain. And so here the RMS is really very low, 2.2 angstroms over 68 residues. And here's another case where you could have a charitable interpretation, because in the crystal structure, there was a the electron density couldn't be seen here. So maybe, so in our model, we're not showing it, but maybe we know more than the crystallographers do about what happens then. So this is, again, in all these pictures, they're colored secondary structure elements with the same color. It goes from blue to red, so just to help parallel. And you see we're starting to make beta, in both this case and the previous, no, this case we're starting to make reasonable beta sheet structures, and this is where the contact order actually turned out to have been very important. Actually, not so much in this one, but in...
This says model 4. What about all the other models?
They were probably pretty, well... And if I think for the first one, you can't. So generally, what when people ask if we can predict structure, they say, well, how many guesses do we get? Probably, I think for that first one, with those disulfide bonds, we could narrow it down. This was model 3. In general, the model 1s weren't bad. But so for a protein like this, so this has historically been the type of structure that structure prediction methods just didn't work on, large beta sheet proteins. I think it has to do with this contact order problem, that high contact order proteins we know can fold five orders of magnitude more slowly than low contact order proteins. And beta sheet proteins with, this is a very non-local, actually this one isn't even all that non-local, but still, we wouldn't typically generate this type of structure. It was only by really doing huge amounts of sampling and then preferentially selecting the high contact order structures that we were able to obtain a structure like this. Well, we knew what the contact order distribution, what that one would expect for a protein of that length. And so we tried to mimic that distribution. It's again to make up for the fact that we're doing these very short folding simulations. And then here we'll show you one more picture. So there's a question about what good are these models? And this is a final example. So this is the true structure here for this protein. It does not have a sequence. The sequence is dissimilar from the sequences of all proteins that are previously studied, known structures. When you generate, this is one of our models for that sequence. You take this model and search the protein data bank, you obtain the closest match is this protein. Now the really interesting thing is that these two proteins actually have the same function. This protein lyses bacteria, and so does this protein. But you can't recognize, there's only 5% sequence identity. So you can't recognize the similarity in function based on the sequence alone. Whereas if you generate a predicted structure, you can use that predicted structure to search the protein structural database using structure-structure comparison methods and identify the similarity in function. So this is sort of, this is now a new direction in my group. We're trying to see if we can use this method now. Ideally, you know, when you go to a new genome, you find that a large fraction, maybe 50%, of the genes are, proteins are not related to a protein of known structure, or maybe 70% are not related to a protein of known structure. And so now we can generate models and use those, take those models, search the structure data bank, and try and learn, get, make guesses about the functions of these proteins are.
What structure homology method did you use?
Well, we use DALI mainly, but we're trying out other ones. Now this is my last overhead. This is getting back to contact order thing. This is something which I really find quite striking. So this is for all of all 20 of the CASP structures, the structures that we generated for CASP. A 1 indicates that we generated the whole protein or at least a large fragment of the protein correctly, and a 0 means that we failed. So the first point, here's contact order here. And what you see is that this is absolute contact order, right? So what you see is that by and large, where we failed was for the higher contact order proteins. It's the first point. Now, the really interesting thing is that on this axis is a measure of what extent the simulations converged. So we generated tens of thousands of independent structures. Now we ask, what's the average RMSD between structures within a cluster after we do the clustering? So this is sort of a measure of simulation convergence. And what you see is that there's this correlation between the extent of convergence of the simulations and the contact order. So of course we don't know the contact order before we start, but you can imagine doing some number of simulations and looking at the extent to which they converge. And basic idea is if the simulations converge, it's probably a low contact order structure. If the simulations don't converge, then it's probably high in contact order. So why might this be? It's a better, the larger the one, the better the z-score, the closer it is to the native structure.
What kind of ballpark of z-score?
Well, they're probably like... if you use Dolly, the z-scores are, they probably range on, the best would be on the order of 6.
Uh-huh. The big ones are on the order of 6.
Probably, yeah.
And small ones?
I don't know, 2 or 3? 2? Okay, so now why might this be? Well, if the native basin, free energy basin, has low contact order, that means that both during folding in solution and folding in the simulation, it will be, short simulations will be able to access it. And so that you could imagine that then many independent simulations will all end up in that local basin, and you'll get convergence. Now suppose, on the other hand, that the native basin has a very non-local structure. So there's a large free energy barrier that must be surpassed to find it. If you're doing many short simulations, on average these simulations are not going to find this low free energy minimum around the native structure. They're going to end out dispersed throughout the folding, throughout the free energy landscape, and you're not going to get convergence. So that may be what's going on here. So you can imagine now, finally, I think, a use for really massive amounts of computing time. Because suppose you do a short simulations, so I've been quite skeptical of this whole blue gene IBM thing, because it's been really the potential functions that have been the problem and are the problem. And I think a lot of the hype just has been unfounded. But I think this is interesting because now you can imagine doing short simulations, finding out that you're in this regime here. The simulations just aren't converging. Well, there, you know what? This suggests a recipe. What you should do is get IBM's computer, generate huge numbers of configurations, and then throw out the vast majority, which are going to be low in contact order, for enrich the high contact order structures, and you may now be able to actually generate reasonable models for these structures. And and that's where I'm going to stop. I'll just acknowledge the people who did this work. David Kim did the work on Protein L. David Riddle did the SH3 the simplified library, and also the map the folding transition state. Chen Yi solved the structure of the simplified SH2. And Kevin, who's here, really was involved in lots of this. He discovered the contact order folding rate correlation that's really been sort of set the whole direction for all of this. And with Seb, who's here, we did some experiments on solution X-ray scattering, showing these proteins don't collapse early in folding. Viara mapped the SH3 folding transition state. Eric developed the simple model for folding. Brian developed this computational design procedure. Sehat actually did the experimental work on switching the transition states. Erica did the protein G work. Kim Simons developed the Rosetta method. Rich was involved in the CASP-4 predictions, and Jerry, as I said, will be giving a talk tomorrow, and he's done all the work on sort of incorporating full LETA models into Rosetta. Charlie, Peter, and Carol have developed a version of Rosetta that seems to be very powerful for NMR structure determination and for homology modeling. And let's see, Lewis sent us the SH3 data, the SSDO data. That work was done by Raphael Gross, and Cam Zhang and Jason O'Neill solved the crystal structures of protein L. So I'll stop there, and thanks a lot.